Orson Welles had one of the most outsized personalities in the history of theater and film, which may be why director Richard Linklater didn't try to cram Welles' whole life into Me and Orson Welles, his new movie devoted to the actor, director, magician. In fact, the entire story takes place during just one week in 1937, and it's as much about the me, in this case an ambitious theater-loving teenager, as it is about Welles himself. The film, which stars Christian Mackay, Zac Efron, and Claire Danes, is based on Robert Capello's 2003 novel of the same title. It's opening tomorrow at the Lincoln Plaza and Angelica Theaters. Richard Linklater is the Oscar-nominated director, known for cult classics like Slackers, Dazed and Confused, Before Sunrise, and A Scanner Darkly, as well as the blockbuster The School of Rock. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hi, Richard.
Thanks for having me back.
In the Sunday Times, you're quoted as saying, Me and Orson Welles is not a biopic. Do you dislike the genre?
Oh, I don't know. It's a difficult genre to pull off, especially when you think of someone with the life that Orson Welles had. How could you depict that in one movie? It would take 100 movies. So it felt comfortable doing one week when he was 22 years old, like, okay, that we can maybe bite off. But any more would be too much.
Well, Welles did bite off the whole life of William Randolph Hearst or somebody akin to him in Citizen Kane.
Some version of himself and Hearst and everybody else, yeah. So,
is this the same time frame covered by Robert Capello in his novel?
Yeah, it's very faithful to the novel.
And it covers an early moment in Welles' career when he was just 22 and in the process of founding the Mercury Theater Company. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's about their first production. He did this kind of radical modern dress version of Julius Caesar that commented on the fascism of the moment. All the lighting, it looked like a Nuremberg rally. The conspirators were kind of like gangsters. So he didn't have a budget. It was a bare stage, a red wall, and lighting, and some music, but it showed the effects of what Welles could conjure with very little.
You know? Now, we're used to this sort of thing. I've seen a Richard III as a fascist or a communist mm-hmm. fantasy. And I've seen Midsummer Night's Dream as something taking place in the Amazon. Welles wasn't the first to do it, was he?
Well, this was groundbreaking. It was 1937. I think it is credited as the first major modern dress Shakespeare. He really just shook up the world and rejuvenated Shakespeare for American audiences. At the time, it's mentioned in the movie that Tallulah Bankhead had this really huge production, multi-million-dollar production of Antony and Cleopatra that was a huge bomb. It was just this boring bomb. And Gielgud had been here the last 18 months doing his Hamlet, very classic British Hamlet. So Welles was out to shake things up.
Well, he'd already shaken things up
yes.
a bit with the voodoo Macbeth,
yeah,
where he appeared as Macbeth in blackface.
No, that was only when the Macbeth was unavailable.
Well, Maurice Evans was supposed to do the part.
I think he was sick. No, Welles was not in that entire he blacked up, I think, just for a performance or two. I could be wrong. But, up in Harlem, he had done that. He'd done The Cradle Will Rock. So he's 22, and he's already, kind of in the process of reinventing the American stage and his early radio career. But this was his first inaugural Mercury Theater production. He was now out of the Federal Theater. That was over. And he and Houseman were striking out on their own to do this repertory theater. And this was their first production. So our film covers like the last 6 days up to opening.
When you're casting a part like Orson Welles, somebody who everybody recognizes and who is also a larger-than-life character, it has to be difficult. Did you know that Christian Mackay was going to be your Welles from the start?
No, I optioned the book, with my own money. We proceeded.
You thought it was going to be Ethan Hawke, right?
Well, the big daunting challenge is just Welles was so iconic. He's etched in all of our minds. Everyone has a relation with him. So what's ultimately magic, I think, about Christian Mackay's performance is he's an unknown.
Especially to American audience. He's been in one film.
Yeah, I think he had a small part in a British film. He's from, England. But, he has this resemblance, but I think the key to his performance, he brings so much of himself to it. Christian himself is this Wellesian figure, big personality, a kid. He's a world-class concert pianist, had traveled the world and was told he was a genius since he was 4 years old. He has this kind of elevated bigness about him. So the key to this performance working is making it really about Christian. You know, it was getting the Wells details as accurately as possible, but it was really about him bringing himself to this part, and that's what he did, I think, so successfully.
Well, one of the hardest parts in dealing with Orson Welles is that he had that magnificent voice.
Yeah.
And you have an actor here who may not be Orson Welles, but you don't say, gee,
yeah.
why'd they hire a tenor to do Orson Welles?
No,
he kind of sounds like him.
Yeah, he was able to get his voice down there. And yeah, it's amazing it was incredible to have this front row seat to this, see this transformation continuously.
Now, you mentioned that Welles didn't have much money. It seems like this film was done on a relatively modest budget, I wondered why. Most of your films have been shot on tight budgets, and after a hit like the School of Rock, I would have thought that people would be throwing money at you.
No. It doesn't really work like that in the film industry. It's like we're all freelance. We're all one film to the next, and, you know, it's a tough time for our industry. And kind of Hollywood has figured out that they make money not doing films like this and only doing $200 million films they can sell and make a billion on. That seems to be working for them really well right now. So the middle films like this are becoming kind of an endangered species. This kind of, they're just sort of not worth their time or their money, however little money it takes. You know.
In the old days, the studios would make the big blockbusters, and then they'd make these movies, mm-hmm. and they'd make even more modest movies. And they never knew. Sometimes the movie that was on a low budget, like All About Eve, would become the big money maker.
Yeah, that becomes the big hit. Well, they knew enough to throw it out there. You know, you never know what anybody really wants. What's in the air? What audiences want? In films, you have to plan it years in advance, so you never know when it comes out. What's the actual mood of the country? An event can happen, and people can next week not want to see a certain film or want to see a film. You don't know.
Well, like we can't. Nobody wants to go see a movie about Iraq, but everybody seems to want to see movies about the end of the world. later, I'll be speaking to Viggo Mortensen about The Road.
Yeah, what is
but
that?
2012 is a big hit.
Well, it's a weird fantasy, apocalyptic fantasy. Everyone entertains those notions. I think that's kind of romantic, always has been. It's key to all religions. But the idea of Iraq, it's a little too present, a little too, you know, it's kind of a bummer subject for people. They don't want to think about it.
David Denby, in his very positive review of your film in The New Yorker, points out that most of your previous work has dealt with pop culture. This is your first foray into the classics. What made you want to try a period piece?
Oh, I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, I've done films that are pretty divorced from the pop culture. I think Before Sunrise and Set are about two people, and there's not a lot of pop culture references in that.
That's almost like a French film in English, starring a French actress.
Yeah, well, that's halfway there, right? But I don't know. Like anybody, I'm interested in history. I'm kind of a throwback, really. I love this era that the movie said. I love films of the 30s. I love old musicals. You know, any film lover loves all movies, but I've always had a particular affinity to this period. And, you know, when I thought about recreating the 30s, there's elements of this movie that kind of have screwball comedy in them, which is funny because it's not a genre Welles as a performer or a director would ever touch. But his life had such a energy and, you know, trajectory to it, and everyone was he was this whirlwind, you know, so it makes for great comedy, I think.
We're talking about Me and Orson Welles, Richard Linklater's new film, which opens tomorrow at the Lincoln Plaza and Angelica theaters. The me is really important here, and that the part of 17-year-old Richard Samuels, played by Zac Efron. Mm-hmm. When you signed him, did you know that he was going to be as hot as he is?
Well, I think, yeah, he was already a bit of a phenomenon from the High School Musical. When I met him, I think the second one was coming out. So, yeah, that was in the air. But I was really just looking, selfishly, I was just looking for the best young actor I could find who had that leading man charisma and quality to go toe-to-toe with, you know, Welles. You know, here, one of the biggest personalities of the 20th century. And I need someone who wouldn't be, you know, who could not be blown off the screen by him. So Zach has that. He's has that leading man quality. And, you know, he's playing a 17-year-old who kind of, Wells underestimates him, and he realizes at some point, oh, this kid's kind of getting away with something. He's dating this older woman in the show, you know, in the show. And
Claire Danes.
Yeah, it turns into a love triangle. It's pretty funny.
The story is told entirely from Richard's perspective. He has, even though he's a schoolboy, he's talked his way into a very small role in Julius Caesar, and that's the same sort of thing that Orson Welles had done to get his career started.
Yeah, famously at the Gate Theater in Dublin, he goes over there, he was 16, and said, oh, I'm a big American star. You know, not saying how young he was, because Welles never was young. You know, he always pretended to be much older. You know, he'd smoke a pipe or a cigar, or facial hair, anything he could do and act much older than he was. But yeah, he sort of talked it. The myth is he talked his way in and convinced them, but they say, oh, yeah, we knew he was a young guy. He gave a bad audition, but there was something special about him, you know, so.
Welles tells Richard that he's a God-created actor, and it turns out that his words aren't as sincere as Richard hopes. Now, was Zac Efron worried at all about a role that was kind of out of type?
No, not.
I know a lot of young actors say, I got to do something that's not like what I've been doing because then people take me more seriously.
Yeah, for Zac, that would be like, oh, playing a street hustler or some, going to some weird extreme, where this character is actually, it was a nice next step for Zac because Zac had a lot of theater experience. He was put in a touring show when he was young, you know, working with these older actors. He said this could be out of his life, you know. So much of what he's experienced in the theater he put into his character here. He just said the character he plays here was a lot cooler than he was, you know. But, yeah, very personal to him. So it felt to him just the role that was closest to who he really is as of yet. You know?
Do you think most people even know, young people, know who Orson Welles is? I have an intern who's really smart, 22 years old, and she said, well, you know, before I saw this film, I really didn't know who Orson Welles was. And I said, you'd never heard of Citizen Kane? Yeah, I kind of heard of Citizen Kane, but she never made the connection.
I know. It's amazing. It's amazing. Well, you realize he's been gone 24 years, so you'd have to be in your mid to late 30s to ever remember him as an icon while in your lifetime.
Or even at the end when he was a fading star, but he was on all the talk shows and doing commercials.
I grew up, he was just this large man with a voice who was on talk shows and doing commercials. It wasn't until I was about 20, I guess. You learn about War of the Worlds in passing, you know, in school, but it wasn't until I was about 20, 21 that I really started seeing all the movies and educating myself. And, you know, he was still around then. So, you fall out of the pop culture, but his work is for all time. It always was. You know, Welles was never that popular an artist. His plays and his radio were huge hits, but I think it took Hollywood to bring him more in line with the realities of the American public's taste, and that his themes were never going to be hugely popular. You know?
And yet I doubt that there's a filmmaker who hasn't studied Citizen Kane or Touch of Evil frame by frame.
Yeah, I've seen Kane so many times, and all his movies. You know, I just saw F for Fake again just recently. I hadn't seen it in a while. And, just amazing, just amazing.
Now, he often was, his problem as a filmmaker was that he lost control of the editing, but he really did want to play a major role in that and rearranging things and writing some of the films. How involved are you? Did you have a hand in writing this screenplay?
Well, my colleagues, Vince Palmo and Holly Gent Palmo, they did the adaptation. I had optioned the book, and we've worked together for, you know, the better part of two decades in various capacities. And they had written a few scripts, and they did the heavy lifting of the adaptation. And then, you know, as a producer and a director, of course, you know, in the rehearsals, I keep shaping it. Whether I write the script or not, I'd say I've probably written or co-written the scripts to 10 or 11 of my movies. And, you know, I change it a lot. You know, just, you know, the director in me kind of gets rid of the writer in you.
And you also seem to encourage improvisation amongst the actors.
Quite a bit in rehearsals. And in this case, every actor in this film had a lot of stage experience, a lot of film experience. And the joy of this was kind of portraying that backstage story of what goes on in the, you know, creating art in collaboration in an ensemble, that's unique. You get that in theater and film, but you don't, you know, when most people think of art, they think of one artist doing it. But it's kind of unique. You know, you think in the arts, this a big group coming together. You get all the hierarchies, the same egos, and differing points of view. So it's fun to portray that.
That's why there's still a controversy over who's really responsible for the script of Citizen Kane.
Well, yeah, those controversies kind of followed Wells always, I think, because the achievement was so great. But you can never, I don't know, you can't really diminish him. You know, his directorial achievement overshadows his own acting achievement. You can't take his acting away from him. That's one of the greatest performances in film history, and it just gets overshadowed by his own directing and those flourishes. But then, you know, in the writing, he really did rewrite and do all that. But, you know, who knows?
Well, this film also deals with betrayal. Mm. Do you think Orson Welles comes across in a positive light ultimately?
Well, I think so, yeah, because he's just – I think Welles was a very generous guy. You look at the credits to Kane and Amberson's, and he brought his Mercury Theater. He's very loyal to those, I think, who were loyal to him and could find their way into his world. I think you – and this is what the film sort of depicts, is where you find a rather, you know, subservient position to the genius in his system. He's created this theater. He's paying for it to do his productions. He's the star. So if you can find your place within that, I think you're good to go. You can't take him on the even level, but you can't do that with any number of people who have that authority. So it's a, I don't know, it shows how you find your place near genius.
The film is very much about love of theater, love of art, and dealing with the geniuses you may be lucky enough to run up against at some point. But it's also about ambition, and one of the characters, Greta, desperately wants to have a short story published specifically in the New Yorker.
Yes, Harold Ross's New Yorker. Yeah, I thought the whole piece is about youthful ambition. Everybody's so young, you know, and they're really finding their way in the world and their way in the arts. So I found that endlessly charming, and that was sort of a valentine to the theater, to actors, and to creativity. You know?
Well, Claire Danes plays Sonia Jones, an assistant to Orson Welles, who's constantly trying to network with directors, producers, and writers. Speaking from your own experience, is this really the way people work their way up in the film industry?
Well, it's how do you couch your ambitions in a, you know, palatable way to those around you? You know, everyone wants to get somewhere, and how do you do that?
Without stabbing somebody in the back?
Right. There's a way to kind of rise to the top. If you're gifted and you're meant to be there, you will sort of do it. It's, you know, ambition without talent is pretty ugly. But ambition with, you know, everyone in this film actually is very good. This is a great production. Greta's story does get published because, and thankfully because of Sonia, who she doesn't even know, but via Richard, you know, Zach's character, she passes on the story. So we're all, it's kind of a wonderful depiction of helping each other out. You know, she's kind of an angel to her and doesn't even know her.
The film was shot on the Isle of Man and in London. People used to go there to save money. Isn't the exchange rate to make that a little more difficult?
I don't think that helped us much. But we couldn't really get funding for this in the U.S., which is sad because it's such an American story, such a New York story. But that was kind of Wellesian of us to go to Europe to get it. And that's what Wells did after, you know, his first two films. He was chasing financing all over the world at a time when it was really difficult to do.
Richard Linklater's latest film is Me and Orson Welles, and it opens tomorrow at the Lincoln Plaza and Angelica Theaters. And I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Nice talking to you.